you like a $100 gift card for the 5150 Apparel Store? Well, right now through the end of May, you can get one. All you got to do is follow Knocking Doors Down on Instagram, like the contest post, tag three friends, and you'll be entered to be one of the five winners selected on Monday, June 1st. Must be 18 years or older to enter.
What's going on, everyone? This is Knocking Doors Down. Jason here with you.
I'm Mikey.
Of course, we're talking with the mental health comedian Frank King today, so that's coming up for you guys. If you didn't hear, just as before the podcast kicked off, we got that contest going on our Instagram where you can win a $100 gift card to the 5150 LTM store to get yourself some gear. Why not? While we're sheltering in place, get yourself hooked up with some 5150 swag, and all you got to do is go there to our Instagram, Knocking Doors Down, like that post, tag three friends, and you are entered to win. That ends at the end of this month, so enter now.
Shop on us. Shop online on us, guys.
Exactly. Why not, right? Well, of course, it's a Mental Health Awareness Month, so we've been focusing on that with the folks that we are speaking with, and also the Carlos Vieira Foundation, which we are aligned with, if you haven't seen. They've got a great program called the Race to End the Stigma, and they've awarded some scholarships for 2020. So if you want more on that, carlosvierafoundation.org. And also, we've posted up on both Facebook and Instagram, just by searching Knocking Doors Down. Give us a follow there. All those winners, and congratulations to them.
Yeah, a lot of great stuff, man. Congrats to those kids. Very good stuff.
Yeah, they all, whether some sort of personal adversity or that of maybe a family member that they overcame, wrote an essay, and it's great that that scholarship is out there and exists. Again, for more details, carlosvierafoundation.org. And we posted up, Mikey, on our Facebook, a story that was sent to us to post by Cassie here. And she said, hey, maybe this is something that might be good for the Knocking Doors Down listeners, is do you think COVID-19 is helping destigmatize mental illness?
I mean, I don't, why not? You know, you got a lot of time to sit back, think, and reflect. I mean, I wouldn't see how not, you know, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily about the destigmatizing, maybe that's the right term, but I know for me, with any personal struggles or other people, that maybe this time is really highlighting it. You know, of course, you with anxieties, know, it's really kind of triggering different stuff that you know, it comes to the surface. And you know, we've been trying to do what we can to let people know that you're connected, you're not alone in this. So my hope, the hard part is, I'm a conversationalist, which happens in person. So I can't really say if it is or isn't, because I'm not really talking with people.
Yeah, you're not out there getting out, seeing other people's perspectives on it.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I don't know. That's a good question.
So I don't know if the overall, what is going on with it, and, you know, everyone and having to follow recommended guidelines, which we should. We will got to protect our health and the health of others. If it's per se destigmatizing it or not. I know for me, I've tried to been more communicative for any kind of help that I need and need to get, you know, to keep myself on track. And I know that's the challenge, right? Any of us, it's, you know, mental illness or not, is kind of, you know, staying the course and continuing to progress, and not to be cliche, but knocking doors down and leading more and more self-improvement, which was the whole mission when we were doing the hashtag KDD challenge, was challenging yourself for 30 days of self-improvement, getting rid of something negative or including something positive, or doing both.
Yeah. So eating healthy, working out, all that good stuff.
Yeah. One of the feedback we got was from Melissa. She said, as a warrior, I don't feel it's destigmatizing it one single bit. Sadly, she says, if any destigmatizing is happening, it's by warriors and the like, and has no impact on COVID shedding light on it. So she feels it's a personal matter within the community to continue to do it and destigmatize it, which once again ties in with the Race to End the Stigma program, that is the Carlos Vieira Foundation mission with that part of the organization. So
no, and like you were saying too, it's being a conversationalist. If you're not out there, well, not everybody, but it goes for me too. If I'm not out there talking about it with people, I'm just there with my own thoughts. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's kind of hard to go based off of that. I would hope that it would be destigmatizing it, right? Because you'd want to get rid of that stigma. But I can't answer that because I don't know. Just like everyone else, we're all kind of locked inside right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you are yet to follow us on social media, follow Knocking Doors Down on Instagram and Facebook. That story that was published by Time.com is up there. Please leave us your feedback. Tell us what you think, and we appreciate you guys following us. Frank King coming your way here in just a second. And if you have yet to subscribe to Knocking Doors Down, do so on the Apple Podcast app, the Google Podcast app, Spotify, or you can go to kddmediacompany.com.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month. The Carlos Vieira Foundation, along with Knocking Doors Down, joined together with the Race to End the Stigma program. The Race to End the Stigma campaign was created to not only change the way people perceive those who are living with mental illness, but also how those who are affected perceive themselves. To find out more about the scholarship program, head over to carlosvieirafoundation.org for more info.
And our guest today, Frank King. How are we?
I live in a nightmare, baby.
Of course, Frank is the mental health comedian. This is, and, you know, you found some sense of humor in the adversities that you've gone through in life. And we'll definitely get into a lot of the great stuff that you've done to help other people with sharing the struggles that you've gone through. But as Mikey and I were you know, getting to know you more, looking at different things that you got on your website, thementalhealthcomedian.com, why don't you tell us a little bit about your childhood? Because I don't think people sometimes understand that depression and mental health issues can very much be hereditary. And it was a case in your family.
Yes, not just one case in my family. It's called generational depression and suicide.
Yeah.
My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was all of 4 years old. I screamed for days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If you want to know the story, it's in my first of 5 TED Talks.
Yes.
He said bragging. It's in the first TED Talk called The Matter of Laugh, L-A-U-G-H, or Death. And I tell the story. I'm going to spare your listeners the triggering event that I experienced at the age of 4 when we found my great aunt had died by suicide.
Yeah.
And I myself in 2010, after kind of the height of the recession, my speaking business had dropped off 80%. My wife and I lost everything in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
Oh, Lord.
And at that point, I learned what the barrel of my gun tastes like. Spoiler alert, I didn't pull the trigger. Yeah, a friend of mine
Thank
had
goodness.
Never heard me. Yeah, never heard me say that out loud. He heard me do a keynote. He came up afterwards. He goes, "Hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger?" Go, "Hey, man, could you try to sound a little less disappointed?"
Yeah, right. Damn.
Right? It's like, you know, isn't it a good thing I'm still here and helping people? You know, let's not be an ass.
Yeah.
So, Frank, obviously some things that you definitely encountered early on in your life with the you know, depression, which I don't think people understand. I know that for me, it's a family background along with the addiction. But how did you kind of segue? Because people find it funny that for me, they normally know me as a very jovial guy, you know, a 20-year background career in radio and now doing this podcast. And I tend to kind of keep a smile on through the sadness. How did you segue into comedy? Was it just laughter kind of helped you throughout youth and you gravitated towards comedy, or?
Well, first let me tell you that I did a morning show as well in Raleigh, North Carolina at WRDU 106, the home of rock and roll, which was the number one morning show in Raleigh in 1993 when I went to work there, when they were hiring comedians to do morning shows.
Right. Mm.
And I was able to drive that morning show, that number one morning show, to number 6 in 18 months, one of my proudest accomplishments. Hey, you guys know there's two kinds of people in radio. People who have been fired, people who are going to be fired. This is the way.
I got to say, I was a miracle. I actually made it 20 years without ever being fired. I don't know how.
I've got a friend who worked at a station in Greensboro, North Carolina, who did at least 20 years, same station. He even survived in 95 or 96 when they began to, you know, create clusters because they changed the rules and said you could have more than one AM or FM. He even survived that.
Yeah.
The radio station I was at was sold for, you know, sold along with 11 others. And most of us, I think I was still working there. I hadn't been fired quite yet. Anyway, the comedy and the mental illness, I believe, are part and parcel of the same wiring. I have a major depression, and something a little more rare called chronic suicidal ideation.
Okay.
Which is, for me, the option of suicide always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. And when I say small, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts unbidden: get it fixed, buy a new one, or I could just kill myself. That's chronic suicidal ideation. Now, the upside of that is I believe that my imagination, comedy writing skills, comedy timing, stage presence, personality is just the flip side of that particular coin. I did a TEDx talk, my third one, called The Evolutionary Advantages of Mental Illness, Mental with Benefits. And it's all about how everybody I've met at whatever age who has a mental illness or two that's not completely dysfunctional often has some kind of superpower.
Right.
You know, they're musical, they're a great writer, they're a comic, they're artistic. And I thought, this cannot be. It cannot be a coincidence. And if you look at the list of celebrities and athletes and politicians and whatever that have a mental illness, one or more, you begin to realize, I think at the end of it, I said, look, you don't have to be mentally ill to be successful, famous, rich, but it doesn't hurt.
Right.
Yeah. So it wasn't like I was depressed and discovered comedy or knew comedy and then got depressed. I was born with both. And told my first joke in the fourth grade. Kids laughed, and I thought, I'm going to do this for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, I took drama, 3 years of drama, never got a good part in any plays. And by my second semester of senior year, I'm like, I believe I see a pattern. I thought, you know, if I do stand-up, I can write, direct, star my own little show every night. So at the senior talent show, this is 1975, I did stand-up comedy. First person ever to do stand-up comedy at the senior talent show. And I won.
Nice.
And I told my mama, I'm going to be a comedian. And she said, well, you're going to college first, son. You can be a goat herder when you graduate, but you're going to be a goat herder with a degree. So I went to Carolina, and I got 2 degrees, one in poli-sci, political science, one in labor management relations, worthless. But I got to tell you, as a comedian, a good liberal arts education is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I had a girlfriend from high school. We made it all the way through college, even though she went someplace else. And married her, big mistake. We had nothing in common. You know what they say, opposites attract. She was pregnant, I wasn't.
Yeah.
So we moved to San Diego. And just by chance, in San Diego, there was a branch of the Comedy Store. It's still there. It's on Pearl and La Jolla. And I just, every time I drove by there, I felt this like magnetic pull. I knew that's where I belonged. And my ex-wife, that was not what she wanted me to do at all. So my fourth TEDx talk is called Suicide, the Secret of My Success, and Dead Man Talking. And the reason this is the secret of my success in comedy especially is I realized that if I didn't change something, you know, a lovely woman shouldn't have been married. I was selling insurance, great business, but not for me. Was not going to the Comedy Store. I thought, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
My second thought was, what the heck? I can divorce my wife, quit my job, try comedy. If it works, and I think it will, then great. If it doesn't, hell, I can still kill myself. So having nothing whatsoever to lose,
right,
that's how I got into comedy. I was able to put it all on one roll of the dice, knowing that if I stayed where I was going to kill myself. And I got to tell you, I've got a comedian friend who had the same basic thought process. I've got a TEDx coaching client who left one 20-year job to pursue another. And when he saw my TEDx talk, he wrote back, because we have a lot more in common than you think, because he thought if he stayed in that 20-year job, which is a good one,
yeah,
that he would kill himself. And he thought he belonged someplace else, living somebody else's life, basically. And he's been very successful. And he's now a TEDx coaching client of mine. We're trying to get him a TEDx talk when the world returns to near normal. So that's how and suicide keeps me alive. The idea of suicidal ideation, because it's always on the table for me.
Right.
It's my, I don't know if you ever saw the show Afterlife with Ricky Gervais on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Second episode is boss is trying to cheer him up because, look, don't try to cheer me up. I'm depressed. I'm suicidal. If it gets too bad, I'll kill myself. Sadly, that's my superpower. So that's my superpower. If it gets too bad, if it weren't for the option of doing that,
right,
it would be very difficult to make it through the difficult times. Because I sit, my book's going to be called, I'm going to write a memoir. It's going to be called Starting the Conversation on Suicide, because that's what everybody hires me to do.
Yeah.
And the subtitle is going to be Living in the Exit Row. And on the cover is a picture of a guy sitting in the window seat in the exit row looking out the window. because that's where I sit all the time. And by the way, Hunter Thompson,
Hunter S. Thompson.
He's got a quote just like that. You know, if it gets too bad, I just hit the exit. I've always got that option. And another person who I think had suicidal ideation. So I've been doing comedy. I did comedy until the time I did radio, and the comedy club thing was kind of crashing in 93.
Right, yeah.
Radio for a couple of years. Yeah, because there was clubs everywhere, and all of a sudden, they weren't opening as fast as they were closing.
Yeah.
And after getting canned by the radio station, my boss, still a friend, by the way, he said to me, "We can go back on the road." And I said, "There is no road." But I've been a clean comic all that time, which cost me dearly, by the way, on the horrible beer bar pool hall honky-tonk one-nighters. Tell us some jokes we can dance to. there comes a slow and you can slow dance. But what I realized was I could do the corporate comedy circuit, you know, the rubber chicken circuit.
Yeah.
So, man, I rode that horse until 2007, and I was making stupid, like $5,000 for 45 minutes of clean comedy. HR will pay a lot of money to make sure, not that you're that funny, but that nobody gets offended.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Every now and then they go, "We're paying you how much for 45 minutes of jokes?" I go, "No. First of all, you're not paying me for 45 minutes of jokes. You're paying me for 7 years of beer bars and pool halls and honky tonks."
Yeah.
Right.
And B, you're paying me that kind of money. So when I get done with my job, you still have a job. And that resonates. But after the recession, they came to me and said, "Look, Frank, we love you dearly. We love your comedy. But we can't pay that kind of money just to tell jokes. You need some takeaways, learning objectives, teach my audience something." I'm like, "Oh, man," because I always wanted to do that. I love the Zig Ziglars of the world, those old school, because I used to watch those guys and think I could do that, but I never figured out what am I going to teach people. So I began to think about my family's history and my history and mental illness, and I took a class. It's called Working Minds, Suicide Prevention as a Workplace Health and Safety Issue.
Yes.
And when you put the word workplace in there, that tells you there's a corporate market for it. And I read Judy Carter's book. Judy Carter wrote the Comedy Bible, and she just wrote the New Testament, the updated one recently. And she also wrote a book called The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And going into the book, I thought I got nothing. Halfway through, I thought, son of a gun, I do have a story, and more than one. So I used her book to cobble together my first TEDx talk. I applied, and I got the first one I applied for, which is rare, to just timing. And then I bought a book called Talk Like TED, which is 9 things long in every great TED talk. And I used that book to refine it. What happened was I went up and auditioned to Vancouver, BC, or I auditioned by application. And then they called me up to Vancouver, BC for an audition. I thought it was Vancouver, Washington, 2 hours away, not 7 hours
away.
Yeah. So I said, "Screw it, I'm fly up." So I flew up, and they called me and they said, "Look, we would love to have you on stage with us at the TEDx, but all we ask is that you mention in your suicide prevention TEDx, you mentioned Robin Williams." And I said, "Well, no, you don't have to ask. He's already in there because I worked with him a couple times."
Yeah.
So that's why I got the gig, because it was just, you know, between the time I applied and the time of the TEDx, he had died by suicide.
Right.
So I got that, and that allowed me to rebrand from comedian to, you know, when I left the clubs, I rebranded from comic, you know, barroom comic to boardroom comedian. And then this TEDx first one allowed me to rebrand in everybody's mind, or begin to, as not just a funny speaker, but a speaker who was funny.
Yeah.
And then I've done 4 TEDx since then. The last one I did was in Durango, Colorado in November. I hadn't posted yet. It will probably next month. It's called Mental Health and the Orgasm: Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly. Yeah.
Nice.
My first line of the TEDx is, "I love my iPhone, but it's my second favorite handheld device."
Yeah, that's right.
There you go.
And it's the only one I've ever gotten a standing ovation for. We had a ball. Oh, my God. It was so much fun. Yeah. And the curation team, they didn't like it. There's a whole team of people that pick, but there's one executive director. So the executive director thought it was I apply half dozen times to get a TEDx, like 15, 16 times before I could find somebody who would even read through it. And the executive director loved it and said to the committee, "I don't care what you think, he's going to be on." So after I got done, one of the young women who was 4 square against me being on the stage at TEDx, she walks up. She goes, "Frank, I didn't think you were a good fit for this TEDx. And I got to tell you, I am so happy I was so wrong."
Oh, that's great.
takes a big person to admit, you know, they made a mistake. Like,
sure, that. Sure.
Sure.
So now I'll have a fifth one coming up, and people go, does it get you booking? No, but it gives you credibility, and it's a great branding tool, and it's, you know, it's good for marketing. And,
right. Yeah, absolutely.
And each one of those is about mental illness, mental health. So they all, you know, it's all, in 2018, January, I had a networking speech, you know, keynote and a customer service keynote and a motivational keynote and a suicide prevention keynote. I thought, you know what? I'm going to, as we used to say in college, when you just picked one fraternity to, you know, to rush, I'm going to suicide it, pardon the pun. I'm just going to do suicide prevention talks, period, paragraph. That's all I'm going to market. I still do comedy, if they ask. I did comedy on cruise ships until middle of February. You guys probably know that.
Right.
Yeah, if you want to cover that later, that's fine. Didn't. I knew I'd get fired. But cruising is like radio. Sooner or later, you're going to get fired. I always wanted to go out in a blaze of glory. I didn't know I was going to go out in that big a blaze. But I've never been fired before and had my name on the front of the Daily Mail in London, the New York Post. That's another story. Anyway, they allowed me to rebrand.
Yeah.
And then when I coach speakers, I said, look, you need to pick a lane. Pick something you're passionate about. You know, that I can wake you out of a sound sleep and you give me 45 minutes on without breathing hard. And second, you got to find your ideal clients. You know, people who not only have a meeting and have a budget and use outside speakers, but they need to hear what you got to say.
Yeah.
And so I looked at the top 10 or 12 at-risk occupations for suicide, and I picked four or five where they're actually trying to do something about it. Construction is number one occupation at risk for suicide.
Really? Mm.
Yes, and they're working very hard to change that. And then I picked dentists because they're like number five or six, veterinarians, five or six, doctors, five or six. And then safety managers, people that work at like Marathon Oil and Shell, where they're all about, you know, like physical safety, but now they're beginning to work very hard on, you know, taking care of the brain above the teeth, the organ.
Yeah, because there is kind of a real stigma in the workplace with mental health. I know that, you know, like I said, 20-year radio career, we didn't start dealing within the workplace until the last couple of years when I was in that situation. You know, I mean, my staff, sometimes when I fell into depression, they had to offset for me and pick up the slack. And there was a couple other people that struggled as well. And, you know, it's good that you're bringing it to light. And I, you know, for me, humor has always been imperative for doing so. So what are you kind of finding with through your stuff is are you finding that when you do these corporate things that maybe they're taking a better look at mental health in the workplace because of the awareness?
Yeah, because as I said, 95% of my clients say to me when I get there, we just brought you in here to start the conversation on suicide. Because even though 8 million people every year in the U.S. contemplate it and 1.4 million attempt it, by the way, women attempt three times as often as men, but men complete because they use a gun.
Right.
Mm. And 47,000 last year died of suicide. That's one every 11 minutes.
Jeez.
Man, I know the COVID-19 is bad. I know that several thousand people in the U.S. have passed away. But if we do this podcast for an hour, five more people will have died of suicide in the hour.
Right.
So I find that by using humor, because somebody asked me, does being a comedian hold you back? Do they not book you because you're a comedian? I go, no, you missed the point. They book me because it's very difficult to spend 45 to 60 minutes talking about death and dying without some kind of, you know, like I did earlier, put the gun in my mouth, spoiler alert.
Right, yeah.
I get my first nervous laugh.
Mm. All right.
In my TEDx, my first TEDx, there's some really dark jokes in there. My grandmother died using an old gas stove. You know, she blew out the pilot light. My great aunt did it with an old Loctite refrigerator where if you get inside, there's no getting out. And I said to the audience, what is it with my family and major appliances? Dear God, I can't drive past a Sears without tearing up. They're taken aback, and then they laugh. But that makes the medicine go down.
Yeah,
it makes it more memorable. The other thing I do is by being a man, and going on stage and being vulnerable and saying, look, this is what I have. There's a song by Big and Rich. I don't know if you guys ever worked in that particular genre of radio, but Big and Rich has a song. They have a song called Somebody's Got to Be Unafraid to Lead the Freak Parade. And that's my job. My job is to get up on stage, let my freak flag fly, and rally my tribe. Mm-hmm. And because I come out especially as a man, and say, this is what's wrong with me. And then I several of my stories, I tear up on stage. I choke up on stage.
Yeah.
You can tell I'm on the verge of tears. It allows other guys to give voice, guys and women, to give voice to their experiences without recrimination. And I got to tell you, the chronic suicidal ideation thing, almost every time I speak, somebody, sometimes more than one somebody, has that chronic suicidal ideation. And they didn't know it had a name, and they thought they were just some kind of freak and all alone. And when they come up afterwards, the relief is palpable. I had a woman at a dental convention a year ago, January. Everybody's falling out of the room. She's coming toward me. I look up, and I can tell from where I, even from a distance, she's crying. When she gets up to me, she's crying so hard she cannot speak. And so I took a chance, and I said, you have chronic suicidal ideation. She nods. I said, you didn't know it had a name. Nod. You just thought you were some kind of freak. Nod. I said, do you have a therapist back home? Nod. Well, when you go back home, set an appointment. Tell your therapist everything you learned. For God's sakes, tell them you Googled it. Don't tell them you learned it from a comedian. And a week later, I got an email from him. I said, you know, Frank, I think I was at the dental conference, that conference, simply to meet you. You have changed my life, and I cannot say that about a lot of people.
Wow.
So, which is very therapeutic for me. But here's the upshot of that. I'm at the University of Montana Billings, because I do colleges as well. Standing outside, starting to snow. It's dusk. Kids gone to get the truck, take back to the hotel. And there's a river in the distance. I can hear the water moving. And I'm thinking about all the people who've come up after my shows. And, you know, and I helped them realize they were not alone. And maybe I steered them just far enough off the path of suicide, they'll live a normal life. And it hit me. Oh, dear God, I'm like that character George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. I've been shown what these people's lives would be like if I were not there to speak and tell them they're not alone. And my second thought was even more sobering, which was, oh, God, now I can't kill myself because I take all these people with me. And my third thought was, and then they pursue me through eternity. You couldn't wait a week.
I don't know. Tell me, you have longer experience with me. Is it a mechanism that helps us kind of correct and shut off that thought?
Well, it. If you, Jason, if you find yourself driving down the road and you look up ahead, there's a bridge abutment, and you're having a bad day, and you're looking at that bridge abutment, and you're thinking, you know, if I just turn the wheel a little bit. Or if you're sitting at a railroad crossing and the train's coming and you look down at the train, you think to yourself, I made the mistake of telling this to a neuronormal person. I freaked them out. They said, how's your morning? I said, well, I took the dog to the doggy daycare. And I said, then I have to go across the railroad tracks to get there. And the train was coming. The arms were coming down. And I said, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I wonder how far I'd have to back up, how fast I'd have to be going to get through the first guard, but not through the second one, so that it actually end up on the track. So I don't want to take them both out and then be alive on the other side and over the railroad for both these. And they're like, I go, it's a math problem. I'm just, how far?
I'm just calculating. It's physics.
It's okay? Just a math problem. Goodness.
Yeah, two trains leave Detroit. One guy pulls on the tracks. But that's suicidal ideation. It's happened so many times. It's not a serious... You know, it's not, I've learned to live with it. I had a young woman at a college conference come up afterwards, said, I enjoyed your keynote. Thank you very much. I said, you're welcome. She said, you made me weep. Again, she goes, when you told your story about your car, get it fixed, buy a new one, you know, or kill yourself. She goes, I've been having those thoughts all my life. I didn't know it had a name. I thought I was some kind of freak. And when I heard you say that, I realized for the first time in my life that I am not alone. And I wept.
Yeah.
And then she says, I was hoping I'd grow out of it. I said, honey, I'm 62. If I'm going to grow out of it, I better get started.
Time is a ticking.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of people think that there's a cure.
Right.
I used to say that I battle depression, and I realized battle implies I can win, and there is no win. We can tie kind of an uneasy truce like North and South Korea, or I can lose and kill myself, but there is no win.
Yes.
There is no so I advise my audiences, you know, I take a holistic approach, diet, exercise, good night's sleep, medication, meditation, and of course, after my fifth TED Talk, masturbation. take matters into your own hands.
That's just the way it's got to go in life.
Yeah. And I get medication. I didn't even take that till I was 60. I took some over-the-counter stuff called SAM-E, S-A-M-E.
I've done SAM-E before years ago.
Yeah, you know, it's good on mild depression. But at 60, I thought, you know, so I asked my doctor, and he prescribed something, and 2 weeks in, my wife noticed the difference. Because, you know how it is. We think nobody notices. We think we're great, and we are great actors. We hide most of it.
Oh, yes.
The third week, though, I had this thought unbidden since I hadn't had it since high school. And bear in mind, I've got a good life. I do what I love for a living. I have a lovely wife and animals and house. But I'd never had this thought since high school, which was, and it just came, it bubbled up unbidden. I like my life. Like, what the? It was almost like the you could just kill yourself. It just bubbled up out of nowhere. And I thought, man, my second thought was, why did I wait so long to take medication? Because you've not been gutting it out for 60 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, it means that when I get depressed, it doesn't last quite as long, and the episodes are farther apart. Because people, great. I think, neuronormal people don't understand major depressive disorder, 2 days to 2 weeks, and it cycles like there's a flat spot on a wheel. It comes back. Can I tell you a quick story about normal people?
Yes,
let's
please.
Hear it. Let's hear it.
I'm really tired. When I get tired, the little editor in my head goes to sleep. And I get in the Uber, nice young man at the wheel, and our eyes meet in the rearview mirror. And he goes, hey, man, how are you? And I thought, you know what? I'm going to tell him. I'm depressed and suicidal. How about you? He goes, what am I supposed to say to that? I said, do you really want to know? He goes, yeah. I go, you're supposed to ask if I have a plan. So long pause. He goes, do you have a plan? Another pause. And he goes, does it involve Uber? Brilliant. Brilliant.
That was good. So, yeah. Frank, how did you end up writing on The Tonight Show?
Yeah, what was that like?
I was on the road. My second wife, I was in San Diego. I won an improv that had come to town. I won the contest, and I was able to book 10 weeks on the road, you know, at comedy clubs. And I said to my girlfriend, who's now my wife for 32 years, I said, I'm going on the road to be a full-time stand-up comic. Do you want to come along? And inexplicably, she said yes. So we everything in storage we couldn't fit into my tiny Dodge Colt. And we hit the road.
Oh, the Colt. What you remember the Colt?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a Colt Turbo, which seems like a... Anyway.
Very unnecessary to put a turbo on a Colt.
Yeah. We're on the road together for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop.
Wow. Goodness.
Opened up for Rosie O'Donnell and Ellen and Seinfeld and Dennis Miller and Adam Sandler, Kevin James, Foxworthy, and Ron White. You know, back when they were all just comics.
Yeah.
And then the reason I came off the road was I got the opportunity to do radio in my old hometown, Raleigh, which I came back, triumphant return. And then that was the genesis of my speaking career. But it's so the comedy and the mental health thing, you know, it's just the way I'm. If somebody said to me, look, one pill, one time, you'll never be depressed again. You'll never have another thought of suicide. However, the one side effect is you'll no longer process information like a comedian. And let me give you an example, because I thought everybody thought the way I did. I think a lot of people think everybody thinks the same.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, Mikey, don't you think that too? Oftentimes you think people think the way you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
what was that, like Mike's fourth syllable? Mike, this is a podcast. There is audio. You can speak up.
I'm just listening, man. I'm taking it all in now. I don't know what to say right now.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm just taking it all in, man. You're doing it all.
Bob and Tom. Bob Kevorkian just sitting there laughing.
Uh-huh. That's you're on. He's on to me. He knows my strategy now.
He's got the mustache.
Frank, I can relate to that. I thought everybody thought the way that I did, you know, especially as a kid or, you know.
Here's how I learned not the case. I'm on a plane, changing plane. Remember when we used to fly?
All those eons ago.
I wish I could fly now because, from Portland to San Antonio is like $88 one way and you have the plane to yourself. It'd be really sweet.
Oh, yeah. Gas prices too, but you can't go anywhere. So you know, all of this is just
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm on a plane at Delta. We changed planes, and we're getting ready to take off for wherever we're headed. And if you've flown Delta, you know the flight attendants are very southern, most of them, and they've just changed the rules a couple of years ago. The FAA said if you have an iPhone or an iPad, you can use it on takeoff or landing if it's in airplane mode.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the flight attendant is none of that's written down anywhere. Brand new rule. So they, she goes through all the standard stuff, seat cushions, floor pad lighting, oxygen mask. And she gets to the part where she's got to tell us about the iPhone and the iPad. So I'm waiting. anticipating. And she goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, due to new FAA regulation." And you can almost hear her thinking. And she gets inspired. "Due to new FAA regulation, if you have small equipment, you can continue playing with it." I'm bent over double laughing. Nobody else on the plane. My seatmate thinks I've lost my mind. He goes, "What?" I go, "Let's review." Before I can review, she comes back on and goes, "If you have large equipment, you got to shove that under seat in front of you." So I fell on my knees. And I realize everybody on the plane heard the very same thing. Just nobody processed it, especially at lightning speed.
Right.
You know, like that. So that's what I can teach you to write stand-up. I can teach you to perform stand-up. I cannot teach you to process.
Yes.
The way my brain, it just works, you know, it just works that way. It's a muscle. You know, I've worked it. Oh, how I got the job for Leno, you ask. That's why I told the road story. I was on the road, and Leno was the permanent guest host of the Tonight Show. And Johnny was very mercurial. Yeah. He would decide on a Friday afternoon he wanted to be off the next week, so he'd announce to the staff, "I'm taking next week off," which meant Jay had four nights to do the show, four monologues, 18 jokes a monologue. And so he wasn't rich or famous at the time. He's a good, hardworking comic, but yeah. You know, 18 jokes, it's like doing morning radio. I was responsible on that radio show for 12 minutes of good, family-friendly comedy every morning. That is a grind.
Yes.
So
I have no idea.
Oh,
no
man.
Idea.
I mean, I was stretching one day, my foot up on my Toyota 4Runner bumper, and there's two flies making love on the hood. And I'm thinking, there's got to be something funny about this, and I thought, I know what it is. So I go in the next day, and I go, "Look, I'm stretching, and these two flies are going at it on the hood of my car. I can't tell you, you know, what position they were each in, but I can tell you this. I heard one fly say to the other fly, 'Let go of my wings. I know what I'm doing.'" And the producer goes, "I would have loved to have been a man on the wall to see that." Oh, man. It's like, dude, mic drop. But anyway, so Leno's facing four nights, 18 jokes a night. So he began to take on contract writers. He'd send you the paperwork. You sign off as a 1099 contractor. And then I was submitting 12 to 24 topical jokes a day.
Yeah.
And getting on, you know, one or two a week when he was doing the, you know, the fill-in. And then he got the job. For real. And a lot of the fact, they call them fax writers back then because everybody faxed in their jokes. A lot of the fax writers didn't get the new fax number. They cut, I'd say 90% of them. And they kept on the rest of us as contract writers.
Yeah.
And so I rode that horse until he left the Tonight Show. And I had two jokes on his very first show because I know comics, they're lazy. And so, trust me, boys, nobody goes into comedy because they have a great work ethic.
Right.
You're working 45 minutes a night and complaining.
Yeah.
Two shows. Anyway.
Son of a.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got a drive. Oh, yeah. Hell.
I remember this MC one time. He's on the couch. He's stoned. He's watching the Golf Channel in the middle of the afternoon. He goes, "I'm looking for an easier job." I go, "Stop looking. You're there." Anyway. So I knew that the other comics would slow down writing because there was a two-week break between Jay and Johnny and Jay. So I was just pumping it in. And I had two jokes in the very first show. And the first one was guy got stung to death by bees in Texas. Wait, this is like 15, 20 years ago. Guy got stung to death. And the punchline was, it wasn't Africanized killer bees. It was just ordinary honeybees upset over the Rodney King verdict. And killed. And then... Then the other one was Dan Quayle. I'm sure you remember Dan Quayle.
Oh, yes.
There was a show called Murphy Brown with Candace Bergen. And on the show, she had a child out of wedlock. And somebody asked, you know, Mr. Conservative Dan Quayle, what he thought about Candace Bergen or her character, Murphy Brown, having a child out of wedlock. He said, it demeans the importance of fathers. And then he said, this is a setup, where would I have been without my dad? And my punchline was, my guess, Vietnam. And it killed. So I had two jokes on the very first show. And I just kept writing, you know, for... And by the way, when it all ended for him at the Tonight Show, I called him up and said, "Look, I'd love to have a little demo tape, you know, just touting my corporate comedy or whatever." And he went, "Well, you know, I got a deal with CNBC. I really can't put that deal with you. But, you know, if you ever get another shot of the morning show... you know, or something like that. I call Helga. That's his assistant, Helga.
Yeah.
Give it a number and a guy's name, and I'll see if I can't strong arm him into giving you the gig." So I've got that in my pocket. I'm waiting for the when the time comes. We have a new book out. Men's mental health. I put the website for the book in the chat box, and so I'm going to send him both the hardcover.
Okay.
And I'm getting ready to voice the Audible version. So I'll send him an MP3 of the Audible version, and just ask him if you wouldn't mind blurbing the cover.
Yeah.
Because print on demand, you can change things.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice to have, Jay Leno, great man.
If not, if you do an audio version, I can try to fake it for you. That's pretty solid there. Yeah, all right.
I could try to help you out, We could at least fake the audio a little bit.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, the audio book.
Celebrity voices impersonated by
We could go back to I could do the Jimmy Stewart for you and just, Frank King, he's a beautiful man. I grew up on Dana Carvey, so it warped my little mind.
I opened for him a number of times.
Oh, nice.
That's great.
And we were both booked at a convention of cardiologists, the Los Angeles chapter of the American College of Cardiology. And the way it was supposed to work was I was going to entertain at lunch, and he was going to entertain at dinner, after dinner. After
lunch. Yeah.
The agent called me and goes, no, Dana's got a conflict. He's going to do the lunch. At the post lunch comedy, you're going to do the post. I've got to follow Dana Carvey. So I'm fine. But apparently, my cardiac comedy was better. They like me better than they did Dana Carvey, at least on the cardiac side.
Right. Which is ironic, being he had a heart attack.
Well, and I've had 2 aortic valve replacements, double bypass, a heart attack, and 3 stents.
Holy Jesus. So,
damn.
Oh, yeah. Well, people ask me about the pandemic. Are you okay? I go, look, I've had 2 aortic valve replacements, double bypass, heart attack, 3 stents. I lost to a puppet on Star Search. This is not the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Anyway, that's how I got to write for Leno. And we had a bunch of us. Every now and then, they changed the fax number. And each time, I got the new fax number. So I just kept, And it's a great exercise of the creative brain pumping in 12 to 24 topical jokes.
Yeah.
Day.
I bet.
And I would once I'd send them to him and the time had passed like 2 nights later, if he didn't do them, then I would slip him in a month. Yeah, I'd cherry pick the best ones and put them in my act.
Yeah.
So, because I began by doing a lot of topical political. Yeah. It's a different time now. I think it'd be very difficult to do topical political unless you're somebody like Lewis Black, who is strictly, and he went to Carolina about the same time I did.
I'll be damned. Yep. Yeah, no, Lewis is great. He's got a way. It doesn't matter what side of the line, at least from my perspective, you stand on. He's just got a great way of getting you to think and get you into laughter about it really fast. And I don't know, maybe that's just my brain, but yeah.
Because you have a discerning brain, the problem is even if you try to balance it out, even if you're picking on both sides, you guys know this. I learned this in radio. It's not what you said.
Yep.
It's not what they heard. It's what they thought they heard.
Yep. Right.
And everything now is filtered through bias on one side or the other. So each side's going to think you took, you favored the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But Lewis has made the commitment that he doesn't care about those people who think that way. He's found his audience, the people who pay him to come to a civic center.
Yeah.
And that is a bold – picking political comedy is a very bold move. It's one of those things you need to dive in head first. Again, he picked a lane, and he is going narrow and deep, not wide. He's not trying. Now, Leno was very much appealed to everybody. Very middle of the road comedy. I mean, I would send in some scathing stuff and funny that I would use in my act, but he wouldn't. He was. And by the way, Jimmy Fallon has tried to stay out of politics, and his ratings have suffered.
Yeah.
Against Kimmel and the other guys.
Yep.
As he's trying to do the Leno thing, and it's just,
Yeah, it's such a polarizing time with it, but normally it is. I mean, that's just politics, It doesn't seem to function if people are rational, it's just got to be crazy shit on the left or crazy shit on the right. Nobody stands in the middle and goes, it's probably somewhere in the middle, and we really could function so much better if we all actually worked together, but... It's not going to happen. It doesn't happen.
I was on campus when I was at Billings, Montana, on campus at the University of Montana, Billings. We were going around to radio stations for doing promo because it was open to the public as well. And 2 nice young men are driving me around. They said, comics have a hard time on campus nowadays because people get offended. Some of them, Dennis Miller, Seinfeld, Chris Rock, I think, they don't do colleges anymore because people whine and get offended and whatever. And they said, now bear in mind, I'm doing a suicide prevention keynote for these guys. They said, you know, you're a comic. Are you worried about coming to campus and offending people? And I said, here's my philosophy. I'm on campus to save people. So can I say the F word?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
No, I said, I'm on campus to save people. So if they get offended, fuck them. Yeah, that's a nice thing. That's the nice thing about being a speaker versus a comedian. I can get away with a whole lot. I don't drop the F-bomb at corporate gigs, but I can get away with, you know. A friend of mine said when I was so depressed and suicidal, you should exercise. And I said, you should bite my ass. I can get away with that at a corporate gig when I could never get away with that at a clean comedy.
Sure.
Because they're paying me for my lived experience, for that, you know, that pain, that suffering. So.
Yeah. Frank, I want to wrap up and just who inspired you to get into comedy? Who are some of your favorite comedians not necessarily mentors, but maybe who you modeled some of your early stuff after when you were finding your voice?
Influences in the beginning, when I was a kid, it was Cosby and Pryor and George Carlin and Cheech and Chong, even though I had no idea what marijuana was.
Sounds so familiar.
Yeah.
Hey, man, what's going on? Hey, man, why don't we go down the street and we'll see Dave, you know?
Yeah, Dave's not here, dude. looks like dog shit. Taste it. Good thing we didn't step in it. Then when I was in Carolina, and we all would watch Johnny, and then I guess Letterman probably was just beginning about the time. Maybe it was pre-Letterman. But anyway, we'd all watch The Tonight Show, the monologue and the guests and whatever, and I'm sitting there in the suite at the college, and I'm thinking, I wonder if anybody else sitting here with me wants to be on that show. And that's who I began to model myself after, Carson, Leno, Letterman. David Brenner was a favorite of mine. That topical Gary Shandling, you know, the poor put upon, can't get a break. So when I went on stage, I was the only guy in San Diego who wore a sport jacket, tie, and khakis. And we had people coming in from East County, which was very, you know, redneck, rural. And I would open my show by going, listen, if you're here from Santee, I should probably identify my outfit. This is a sport jacket and a tie. And I formed a company called White Collar Comedy, Humor for the Pinstripe Personality. I got started doing, you know, squeaky clean, and people come up to me with a newspaper. Hand me the LA Times before I went on and goes, here's the article. Write a joke on this. And I'd sit there and I'd go up on stage and I'd nail a topical joke because that's what because I've been reading the paper all my life and thinking those things. I recently began doing something a year or two ago called Tercel Talks, T-E-R-C-E-L. Okay. If you look on YouTube, type in Tercel, T-E-R-C-E-L, the Toyota. Talks, you'll find a dozen or more, because all my life I've been talking into the rearview mirror, you know, running jokes, running gags, you know, my opinions, whatever. And I thought, you know, if I buy a clip and turn the phone camera around, just keep my eyes on the road, but just, you know, and it's, I posted my first one. Oh, get this. Guy comes up to me. I made a really sweet move in traffic, downtown Springfield, cut across two, a very LA move, found an opening like NASCAR, cut across two lanes, swung it around, stopped right there at the stoplight, look in my rearview mirror, policeman. And so, guy, you know, I start to turn the corner, woo! So I pull over in my 84 Tercel, a babe magnet, by the way. I got to have the windows rolled up, otherwise chicks did dive in. And I roll down my window because, you know, it's one of those. And a cop comes up and I go, hey, man, was it that maneuver I did coming out of the parking lot, swinging around there like NASCAR? He goes, no, man, that was sweet. He goes, you have any paperwork for this thing? As if because it's an 84 Tercel, I wouldn't have any paperwork.
Right.
I go, yes. I go, why'd you pull me over? He goes, well, on the back of your car, you got two license plates. Well, my father-in-law left us the car, and the old license plate was welded with rust onto the back. So I just slapped the new Oregon plate over it. But you can see the outline of the old plate. So he goes, the Baron-Moss 84 Tercel. He goes, well, you know, two license plates, Frank, that might indicate the car is stolen. I said, how low would my self-esteem have to be? I go, you and I both know that, you know, the penalty, the jail time, same for BMW. Why would not? Now he's laughing. And so that was one of the Tercel talks. As soon as he left, I turned the camera on. I go, you guys not going to believe what just happened. The guy thought I stole the Tercel. I go back to North Carolina to work radio for a summer, and for my old boss who hired me in 93 and then called me back, I got a job for you. We've been down that road, Phil. And I had I had him ship the 84 Tercel. It cost more to ship it than it was worth. But it's an 84 Tercel from Oregon with Oregon plates and a Grateful Dead bumper sticker, which, by the way, to the Raleigh police is, what's it called? When they can't stop you unless they've got
probable cause.
Yes, there's probable cause.
Grateful Dead sticker, probable cause in the South. Makes sense.
Yeah, with an Oregon plate, and they just passed recreational weed. So I got pulled over half dozen times when I get out of the car. I got the dog, you know.
Right.
The dog's looking at me like, you got no self-esteem? Like, it's an 84 Tercel. Anyway, that's my – so if your listeners go to Tercel Talk or Tercel Talks, they'll find – and I'm going to start doing them again because when I did the first one, I just did it as a lark. And a buddy of mine goes, hey, man, when's that next Tercel Talk coming out?
That's good stuff. That's awesome. Frank, if people want to find out more about you, I know that you're getting the book going. Where can they go to find all the info on you, good sir?
They go to my website, TheMentalHealthComedian.com, TheMentalHealthComedian.com. And that's my handle on Facebook. It's Instagram, okay. Twitter. It's all basically, you type in The Mental Health Comedian, my stuff will. If you type in comedian coronavirus, Cambodia, quarantine, you'll find out more about me than you ever care. You go Time Magazine, Newsweek, Inside Edition, Entertainment Tonight. Oh, my God.
Oh, well, Frank, we appreciate your time, man. It's been awesome. My face hurts. I'm going to have to laugh too
cheeks
much. So I'm going to have to go figure out whatever it is to relax this. But we really appreciate your time. And thank you for opening up here to the audience, because, you know, mental health is such a thing, and it's one of our staples here that we want to help people with and know that they're not alone. And really our mission and motto is, if we can help just one person, it's all worth it. So
I tell employers, people that hire me, I go, look, we save one person's life, that we have a good day's work. Let me give you my phone number, by the way.
Sure.
For the podcast listeners, it's 858-405-5653, which is LAFF, 858-405-5653. What I tell people is, if you're suicidal, call the lifeline.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you're mentally ill, depressed, whatever, just having a really bad day, call a crazy person. Mm-hmm. Because we're not going to judge, we're just going to listen.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. We appreciate your time. Mr. Frank King.
5150 is a lifestyle. We believe in pushing yourself, finding your passion, knowing your dreams, and working hard, always striving to make those dreams a reality. We believe life's too short to sit back and say, what if? Go after it, grab it, and make it happen. Being 5150 is committing to that long, hard road ahead that you know is going to be tough, but the most rewarding. That's living the madness. That's 5150. If you're living the 5150 lifestyle, then celebrate by rocking the goods. Listeners of Knocking Doors Down, head over to 5150LTM.com. That website again, 5150LTM.com.
Oh, well, we thank Frank King once again for coming on Knocking Doors Down, sharing his story. It is such a unique and interesting story, to say the least.
Absolutely.
Don't you think, Mikey?
Yeah, no, for sure. The three options, you know, the car problems, it's you know, just goes to show that there's a lot of people dealing with a lot of mental stuff that you pass them in the grocery store and you have no idea that that's the kind of stuff that's on their mind.
Someone is dealing with something every day that you see and meet, and you know, that's why I aim to be as kind and gracious as possible as I can to my fellow man. And like he said, that it was the whole purpose and mission of what we're trying to get out here in helping at least one person, and just one person at a time, was he said he totally sees that now, that adversity, that challenge of who he is, what's going on within his own brain, as his strength.
Right.
And that's the ultimate takeaway I took, is that, yeah, I may not be able to do comedy if I didn't have this. I wouldn't have been able to write for The Tonight Show. I wouldn't have been able to travel the world on cruise ships and, you know, meet so many interesting people and touch some lives and do a TED Talk. Is that this whole adversity that I was presented with, which he pointed out was part of his family, you know, genes, mm-hmm. that it ran in his family, presented him the life that he has.
Sure.
And sometimes I think we forget that, or we have yet to start our mission in turning that adversity into how are we giving back to society, not just ourselves, our families, but others, to help them overcome whatever they are faced and challenged with, and encouraging them and being a constant reminder that you can.
Mm-hmm. You know what I really liked too was, what was it, suicidal ideation? Is that what it's called? Yeah. So he has that, unfortunately, but he makes light of it. You know, he can joke about it. He can laugh about it. When I hear about it, you know, he'll be saying something and it's you know, he's making a joke. I can't laugh. Like, I don't know, like, should I laugh? Is he being serious? Like, I don't know if he's, you know, like, oh, that's some heavy shit. You know, like, I didn't know if I could laugh or not, but it is a joke. Well, not that it's a joke that he was making, and I'm just like, oh man, it seems very unfortunate, but he's laughing about it and he has it. So it's like, okay, well, you know, more power to him for shedding light on, you know, a very dark situation.
And I think that's all we can do, which once again goes back to Carlos Vieira's book, Knocking Doors Down, that was the spawned all of this on, and the mission that we're going on is, you know, his whole thing was about sharing it, and there's some dark stuff in there, but now for who he is now, the success that he's having, the things that he's turned it to be able to do within his community, and hopefully more further abroad. And, you know, that's the goal, is that the reach goes more farther abroad. We get listeners of Knocking Doors Down around the world. You know, we can see that you guys are out there, and we appreciate you sharing it. So we are incredibly thankful for the listenership and the continued support. And on that note, anything else, Mikey?
That is it. That is it for this time, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, keep knocking doors down. And again, our mission is to help one person at a time.
This podcast contains the views and opinions of the Knocking Doors Down hosts and their guests to the show. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for informational purposes only. And because each person is sharing their unique perspective, please consult your healthcare professional for any medical questions. Views and opinions expressed in the podcast and website are our own and do not represent that of our places of work. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or correction of errors. Privacy is of the utmost importance to us. For those wishing anonymity, people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect confidentiality at the request of certain guests. This website or podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast or website. In no way does listening, reading, emailing, or interacting on social media with their content establish a doctor-patient relationship. If you find any errors in any of the content of this podcast or blogs, please send a message through the contact page. This podcast is owned by KDD Media Company.